Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the September 12th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday. I want to open the phones to you, our listeners. In 1997, a group of politically influential Washington insiders, headed by neocons Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, and united by their belief in U.S. military dominance and their unconditional support for Israel, formed the Project for a New American Century. Its goal was for the U.S. to use its military power to exert full-scale dominance across the globe, with Iraq's Saddam Hussein slated as its first target. According to PNAC's Statement of Principles, actually written in 2000, quote, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, end quote. On September 11, 2001, 11 years ago yesterday, after a number of the signatories to the PNAC document had become important figures in and around the George Bush White House, not the least of whom was Vice President Dick Cheney, they got their Pearl Harbor. There are a substantial number of Americans who insist they not only got it, they produced it, if not exactly in the manner that President Roosevelt's administration induced Japan to attack Pearl Harbor in 1941, but with the same result. The American public was made ready to support a war. That's not, however, what we'll be talking about today. I've done a number of programs in the past on what happened on 9/11, and we are no closer to a genuine investigation of that subject than we were on the day of the attack. I don't expect we will ever see one. Since the Project for New American Century, having apparently done what it was intended to do, its two guiding lights, Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, closed it down in 2007 and reemerged in 2009 as the Foreign Policy Initiative, or as one supporter has called it, PNAC 2.0. Kristol also found time to start another organization, the Emergency Committee for Israel, which has put millions of dollars into billboards and TV ads targeting politicians who are considered insufficiently supportive of Israel and President Obama as one of its targets. I should mention that Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, strangely enough, is the official spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's State Department. As if the foreign policy initiative were not enough, 2 days after 9/11, a dormant Jewish organization, Emet, emerged as the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, whose motto is Fighting Terrorism and Protecting Freedom. Both these organizations are actively engaged in promoting a U.S. war on Iran, a military intervention in Syria, and regime change in both countries. They are being assisted in their efforts by the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or WINEP, which was created in 1985 by AIPAC, Israel's registered lobby, in order to play a more direct role in shaping U.S. policy, according to Israel's dictates, than by simply lobbying members of Congress. I have to acknowledge that notwithstanding the detriment to our country and its future that these organizations have engendered, they have been, by Washington standards, all success stories. Today, about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be discussing it further in depth, the modus operandi of these organizations, when I speak once again with Phil Giraldi, a former CIA counterintelligence officer who is quite knowledgeable on the subject of Israel influence over U.S. foreign policy through its Washington surrogates. In the meantime, let's take a look at the extent of that influence over both our political parties. That is what should be embarrassingly huge, was amply demonstrated last week by the hastily put together efforts of the Democratic Party to restore planks in the party platform recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital and the presence of God and watching over the heads of the American people. How and why both Jerusalem and God were left off the platform this time around has not been revealed, but for those who didn't see and hear the segment on Democracy Now!, President Obama reportedly told his party lieutenants to fix it. And so they did, as the convention opened its second session on Tuesday, before the national network coverage began, but while some cameras were rolling. Assigned to ask the delegates in the auditorium to approve an amendment that would put Jehovah and the Holy City back in the sacred platform was Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, one of the Israel lobby's favorites in the country's Latino community. It was a sequence that ended up on Jon Stewart's Daily Show and may have put an end to Villaraigosa's political career. After announcing the two-thirds vote was needed for the passage of the amendment and allowing no discussion, he asked for those supporting it to shout aye, and a lusty cry came in response. What he was not prepared for was a lusty cry that was slightly louder from the nays. Perplexed, Vero goes to try it again. This time, the ayes and the nays were approximately equal. Villaraigosa was stumped. This wasn't the way it was supposed to go. After a pause during which a woman on stage seemed to suggest that he just go with it, Villaraigosa tried one more time. And this time, though the nays clearly outshadowed the ayes, Villaraigosa remembered who had brought him to the dance and declared the amendment had received the necessary two-thirds vote and that support for Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital and God were once again recognized by the Democrats. If you didn't hear it, this is what it sounded like.
Governor, would you like to make your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This summer, I was proud to serve this party as the Platform Drafting Committee Chair. As the chair, I come before you today to discuss two important matters related to our party's national platform. As an ordained United Methodist minister, I am here to attest and affirm that our faith and belief in God is central to the American story and informs the values we've expressed in our party's platform. In addition, President Obama recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and our party's platform should as well. Mr. Chairman, I have submitted my amendment in writing, and I believe it is being projected on the screen for the delegates to see. I move adoption of the amendment as submitted and shown to the delegates.
A motion has been made. Is there a second? Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, the matter requires a two-thirds vote in the affirmative. All those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no.
No.
In the opinion of the... Let me do that again. All of those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no. I guess.
You've got a rule, and then you've got to let them do what they're going to do. Rule.
I'll do that one more time. All those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no.
No.
In the opinion of the chair, two-thirds have voted in the affirmative. The motion is adopted. And the platform has been amended as shown on the screen. Thank you very much. Thank you.
There you have it. Although Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman introduced this segment by suggesting that, quote, critics ask why GOP is dictating the Democrats' platform, it wasn't the GOP doing the dictating, unless one believes the Republican-Jewish Coalition, which discovered and tweeted the missing references, controls the Republican Party. How and why the reference to Jerusalem was omitted remains a mystery. According to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, or JTA, quote, a Jewish official speaking on background said that at least three American-Israel Public Affairs Committee members, that is, AIPAC officials, were present during the entire period when the platform was drafted last month in Minneapolis. Other Democratic and Jewish officials confirmed AIPAC's participation in the process, according to the JTA story. Former Congressman Robert Wexler said he had consulted with AIPAC officials on parts of the platform but had not discussed Jerusalem with them. A source close to AIPAC, according to the JTA, said the group never saw the full platform language and that AIPAC officials were not in the room when the platform was being drafted. The source noted that AIPAC, in its written submissions, had made the case for including a reference to Jerusalem as Israel's capital, but also noted that AIPAC regarded the final draft Israel sections of both party platforms as strong, end quote. Well, what may have happened is what the right-leaning AIPAC wanted to happen. The Democrats were embarrassed before pro-Israel Jewish voters who comprised key voting blocks in at least four states. Haaretz's Hemi Shalev, who was covering the convention for the Israeli newspaper, summed up the situation in a way that no American publication or broadcaster, including Democracy Now!, would dare to do. Quote, Hemi Shalev, "It is difficult to tell just what do Americans themselves think when they see their candidates swear allegiance to Israel as if it were part and parcel of the national anthem and flag." What do they think of the situation where every single deviation from blind support for the Israeli government's position is considered heresy and treason, asked Shalev. It may be a reasonable position for impassioned Christians and loyal Jews, but most Americans are neither. And in their inner hearts, they may just wonder about that distant country's source of power that can cast such a giant pall on U.S. politics and which could also drag their country into a war which they do not want to fight. That's from Hemi Shalev, writing in Haaretz last Thursday. Again, you will never hear a comment like that in the U.S. media, neither mainstream or alternative, but it is not uncommon in Israel, where journalists do not operate under the same constraints as their American counterparts do. Well, the U.S. Congress is not the only legislative body that can be rightly considered Israeli occupied. Take the California State Assembly, for example. On August 28th, that less than August body passed by a unanimous 80-0 vote a resolution that portrayed pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli activism on California university campuses as anti-Semitic and posing a threat to the well-being of Jewish students, despite the fact that no such resolution had been asked for by any college campus. While the legislature may have intended to record its opposition to alleged anti-Semitism on state university campuses, it defined anti-Semitism so broadly as to include legitimate political activities in opposition to Israeli government practices that would clearly be protected by the First Amendment and the accepted definitions of academic freedom. These include accusations that Israel has conducted ethnic cleansing, has committed crimes against humanity, practices apartheid, and campaigns that call for boycotting, sanctioning, and divesting from Israel. Among the 66 co-sponsors of this resolution, which, though non-binding, calls for the restricting of free speech rights of Palestinian Americans and their supporters, could be found the name of our Assemblyman Wes Chesbro and the man who is likely to be our next member of Congress, Jared Huffman, who is currently in the State Assembly representing Marin County. Last week, I contacted the offices of both Chesbro and Huffman to get written explanations for their support of the resolution, and did so again yesterday, and late last night I received a response from Jared Huffman. Regarding my support of H.R. 35, he wrote, I take anti-Semitism very seriously. I believe it is on the rise, and that's why I supported H.R. 35. Upon reflecting on the wording of H.R. 35, however, I agree that it is overly broad and should have been more narrowly focused to avoid the implication that all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. I understood H.R. 35 to be mainly focused on the so-called BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, he continued, which has gotten some traction on college campuses and which I strongly oppose. The BDS movement has singled out and applied a blatant double standard toward Israel. This is itself can be seen as a form of anti-Semitism or racism, in an attempt to delegitimize the Jewish state, wrote Huffman, while praising and supporting groups like Hamas, which to this day vows in its charter to destroy Israel and kill all of its Jewish inhabitants. BDS leaders are advocates of a one-state solution for the Israel-Palestine conflict. I agree with H.R. 35's condemnation of the BDS movement, and so should anyone else who believes Israel has a right to exist as a state and Israeli Jews have a right to live in peace and security. That said, Huffman's statement concluded, H.R. 35 should have concluded language acknowledging the difference between overt and de facto anti-Semitism, such as the BDS movement, the use of swastikas, etc., and legitimate forms of pro-Palestinian or anti-Israeli expression that are perfectly acceptable as part of the political debate on any college campus. I regret that my colleagues and I did not do a good enough job of scrutinizing the resolution to ensure that it was carefully written. End quote. And that was a statement by First District Assemblyman and very likely our next member of Congress, Jared Huffman. Well, for the record, although I would take umbrage with the comparison of writing a swastika to the BDS movement, while many supporters of the Boycott Israel movement do support a one-state solution, the BDS movement takes no position on the outcome. Furthermore, it does not support or have the backing of Hamas. In fact, on its website, which is available online, it criticizes Hamas for the restricting of the movement of Palestinians within Gaza and those who seek to leave it.